Hi, my name is Chris. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." Tonight, I get the honor of introducing our speaker. He asked me to come up and tell my story at the Alpharetta Room last year, and then asked me to give him his 15-year medallion right on the spot. That was wonderful. Troy's a wonderful servant of AA, and he posted a picture this morning of himself when he enlisted in the Air Force when he was, 18 years old. I thought, good Lord, he looked like a little baby. And he said, if he knew better now. But it is Memorial Day, so, you know, let's... think about the people that have died for serving our country and the ones who have been willing to. So with that, I will give you our speaker, Troy Abrams from the Alpharetta Group.
Hey, everybody. Please pray for me. My name is Troy, and I am an alcoholic. Before we get started, I always like to start with giving some information about myself. You can reach me at 678-596-8683. Please feel free to give me a call at any time if you should need me. I have gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. His name is Carlos C. I have a home group, the Alpharetta Group, and I sponsor others as well. Some of the guys I sponsor are here tonight, and I want to thank them for giving me a little support and showing up. Because, you know, sometimes it's scary getting up here and talking, you know. Sometimes it's challenging. So it helps to see a friendly face or two, even though I know each of you. I haven't met you, but I know you if you're sitting in this room. Before we go forward, it is Memorial Day, so if you don't mind, I'm going to just take a little moment of silence for our fallen. God bless our soldiers, our airmen, and our sailors. You know, I'm just a garden variety alcoholic and addict. I can't tell you that, you know, I am the worst I've ever seen. I can't tell you I'm the best I've ever seen. What I do know is that I reached a place where it was insufferable. That the misery of my life was one that challenged me every day to get up out of bed. If you know anything about that, you might have what I have. You know, I have a disease called alcoholism, not wasm. You know, it is. But I have been relieved, and I want to tell you that I was rescued by He who presides over us all. You know, I mean, you couldn't do it. My mom and dad couldn't do it. My brothers and sisters, though they tried, could not do it. You know, it wasn't that I didn't want to stop. There was a time when I wanted to stop, but I couldn't stop. I was having this out-of-body experience where I'd watch myself get in my car, and the car just knows where to go, you know? How'd we end up here? Well, while we're here, we might as well, you know? And I'd get out of the car, and I'd take the money out of my pocket, and I'd put it on the counter, and I'd point, and they would put it right in front of me. I'd grab it. Is there change? Thank you. I'd take my change, and now I felt like I can live, I can breathe, because I got this thing in my hand. You know, before it came into my hand, before I had custody of this thing, my body was asking for it. My body was saying, I need this thing. You can't go on without this thing, you know. And it seemed like there was a voice in my head that sounded just like me that was in agreement with my body. And the two of them conspired to take me into this place, put my money that I worked for down on this counter, and buy this thing that I no longer wanted, but I had to have. The power of choice was removed from me. There was a time, and I can tell you I remember when it was, but I can't tell you that I remember when it changed. But there was a time when I would drink and smoke and use illicit stuff recreationally, you know, where it was fun. There was laughter, you know. There was enjoyment and pleasure, I can even say. But at some point, and I don't know when that was, it changed. It stopped being recreational, and it became necessary. You know, I was born in Guyana, South America, and that's the only English-speaking country in South America. And my family migrated here when I was 8.5 years old. But I can remember even beyond that, before even coming to the United States, I think I was about 6 years old when I had my first drink. And it was strictly about doing what I saw being done around me. You know, I was not a victim. You know, my environment didn't take over my mentality. You know, I reached out and I wanted to drink. You know, my dad and his brothers drank, and from time to time they would come to the house, and you know, my aunts and my mom would be in the living room, and my dad and his brothers would be in the kitchen either playing dominoes or doing something. And I want to be with them, you know. And so many times I remember being told, go hang out with your mom. You know, inside of my head I would hear me say, no, I want to be with you. You know, I want to hang out with the guys. You know, and they'd sit down at the table and they'd be pouring. You know, Guyana is driven by two things, sugarcane and rum. You know, and I tell you, it's an integral part of the culture there, you know, is to have a drink. So they would sit down and they'd have their glasses and the ice clinking around, and something about that clinking ice, you know. And my dad would sit his drink down, and I'd come up to him and smile, and I'd reach for the drink, and he'd get out of here, smack my hand. You know, but after he'd had a couple, you know, he cared less and less about me doing that, you know. And and I managed to get my hand around it, and I managed to get a couple of sips down my throat. And instead of being scolded, you know, I was looked at as like entertainment, you know, because once I had that alcohol in me, I would run around, spin on the ground, twirl. I would do anything just to get their attention. And I would be a part of. You know, I remember my dad picking me up off the floor and putting me in my bed and laughing, you know. Now, at 6 years old, I did not drink alcoholically. But what I did do was to reach for alcohol for an ultimate goal, the attention. You see, alcohol really is not my problem. Troy is my problem. Troy starves for things. He's starving for attention. He's starving for that limelight. And he's starving for the love that he thinks he needs. And I didn't know that then, but I know it now, having worked the steps. Because, you know, what the steps has exposed me to is me. You see, I told myself certain untruths. I lied to myself. And when I lie to me, I can always lie to you. And living in lies, living in this deceitful manner, changes a person. Turns me into something that I'm not. And it gets to the place where I don't even recognize myself. I remember even in the later days of my using that I would walk past the mirror and stop and come back and look at myself. You know, and I remember standing in the mirror looking at myself saying, look at you. Look at you. You know, even as a child, I remember, you know, having this yearning and this need, this unspoken want, you know, for my parents' attention. And as I grew, it became more than just my parents' attention. It seemed like I even wanted the attention of perfect strangers. Now, I'm not saying that to tell you that, you know, I acted in this way because I was the victim of this internal inferiority complex. I don't know all about that. But I can tell you that through the work in this program that I'm able to look at it and be aware of some of my shortcomings. Be aware. And that awareness now gives me an opportunity to change. Because ultimately, that's why we're all here. We occupy these seats in order to find a way to change. Because of ourselves, we didn't know how. How am I going to be able to change the person that I was becoming when I didn't even know I was becoming that person? You see, this is something that my brain couldn't use to solve. You see, you can't use a sick brain to solve a sick brain. I've heard it. But I can tell you, I've lived it. You know, even in the misery, it seemed that misery became so comfortable, so nice to me, so soft and warm, you know. In the later days, ending up in jail was just another week, you know. All right. Well, the first couple of times, you know, somebody would bail me out. And then after a while, it would be 30 days here. 45 days here, 60 days here, you know. And then the last time it was 9 months. It was really a year, but I only did 9 months. You know, the thing about this disease is that it is subtle, and it uses my brain so it is just as smart as I am. And if you think you're smarter than this disease, you're in for a rough ride. One of the things that I had to do was to surrender to the fact that I know that this disease beat me. I know I was whooped. And I couldn't find a way out. You know, I would walk around as if I knew that I had to stay in control, because I thought that if I appeared to have it in control, then, you know, appearances were all that matter. But my life was falling apart. You know, it seemed that I didn't have any answers, but I didn't know it. I acted as if I did. Now I stand before you, I will humbly admit to you that I have no answers. You know, I have no answers, but what I do have is a solution that works. If I take the actions that are necessary, I'm able to survive today without picking up a drink or a drug. I can make it back to my pillow, and let me tell you, y'all, that is my mission. Just to make it back to my pillow, clean and sober. And sometimes it's ugly. It's an ugly win. I like to call it the ugly win. You know, when you had a bad day, when somebody said no to you, things didn't go your way, but you made it home, and you hit that pillow, and you say, yeah, I didn't pick up. You see, I'm always being watched, and I'm not being watched by you. I'm being watched by that alcoholic dope fiend inside of me. He wants to see, is this going to get him? You see, I'm like this house, and my disease is like a burglar that's constantly pacing around it, casing it, looking for that crack in the door or that open window. You see, what happens is life shows up sometimes, and somebody is going to say no to you. Somebody's going to break your heart. Somebody's going to, you know, upset your apple cart. But ultimately, what I've got today are living skills where I'm able to go through whatever it is that comes down the pike and not pick up a drink or a drug. Happy, joyous, and free is what this big book tells me that my God wants me to be. Happy, joyous, and free. It didn't say anything, only on the bad days can you have a drink. Or, you know, only on the good days can you behave in fellowship with each other. No, you know, there's no gray area. There's no right way to do the wrong thing. You know, I used to think that if I told just a little bit of a lie or omitted something, that, you know, that's all right. We can still, you know, make that work. You see, step one told me that I had to admit that I had a problem. What that problem was Troy. You know, I had to admit that Troy was the problem, and I didn't have any solutions. Coming in here, I admitted, I raised my hand, but first, before I even obtained a seat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to drive my car to a meeting. I had to find the power necessary just to drive my car to a meeting. So I didn't do this. If I could have done it, I would have done it a long time ago. This was given to me, the strength to get in the car and drive to a meeting. That strength was given to me because of myself, I couldn't do it. And then when I got here, I got out of the car. That strength I did not have. And when I got out of the car, I came in the room and I took a seat. That strength I did not have. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous told me that by surrendering in this manner, and only in this manner, was I able to be A, rescued from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, to turn my misery into an asset where someone else can be helped, and 3, find this happy, joyous, and free life. And all of those promises, each and every one of them has come true. My sobriety day is October 22nd, 2001. And I can stand today and tell you that within those 15 years, I have been challenged in ways that I never saw. You know, my son was born 14 years ago, and he was 2 pounds. And when he was born, one of the nurses said, Mr. Abrams, you know, we're going to recommend that you not name him just yet. My son Troy Jr. was born 2 pounds, 2 ounces, and right next to him in an incubator, right next to him was another child. Her name was Amanda, and she was born 5 pounds. They were both premature, but we were praying for my son to get to 5 pounds. You know, 8 days later, Amanda died. You know, one of the things that I can tell you about AA is that this fellowship is strong. Because when I was unable to be there, you were there. You know, I would get off work at 6 o'clock and race to Northside, and I'd get there and there'd be 3 or 4 of you guys standing there either praying out in the lobby, or one of you would be in the room with my son touching his incubator, praying with him. I owe this program a lot. You know, I would not forget that. I remember when I was told not to name him, I came outside and I'm crying. And this man, I don't even know where he came from. And he came up to me and he was like, what's going on? And you've taught me not to hold on to my stuff, that I can be free and let it go. And I told him then what I was told upstairs, and he said, let me show you something. And he reached in his pocket and he came out with this little album. Back in the day, they had, you know, those albums, you know, pictures were not just on your phone. They were actually in a picture album. And he showed me pictures of his son, and his son looked just like my son did. He had tubes going in and out of his mouth. His eyes were covered with this padding to protect him from the light. And, you know, he kept flipping, and he would say, you know, and that was 13 weeks that we went through it. And here, though, this is when he was in kindergarten. And then this is when he graduated from middle school. And this is when he graduated from high school. And he walked me through that process from a child, he said, that was born prematurely just like mine. You know, I don't know who that man was, but what I understand today about the God that I serve is that he will put people in my life that come with a word just for me. Just for me. And when I know that, it removes all doubt, you know, and once doubt has been removed, then all things are possible. I'm my worst enemy. I'm the biggest obstacle in my life. Step two taught me that, you know, if I did certain things, that I can free myself of that burden of self. You know, being aware that there is a God and He can take care of whatever problems may be. And making that admission and sharing it with another person has some power. There's some energy. Synergy is what they call it. You know, because the days that I'm not strong, you're strong for me, and you come to me and you share that and bring me up. You know, that third step where it talks about turning my will and my life over. You know, that's not something that's possible for me. You know, I had to pray. I believe it took me at least 3 months to get to that place where I knew that this would work. And how I knew that is by attending meetings frequently and listening. How I knew that is by watching you all and how your life was changing. You know, there are samples and examples, even now in this room, that tell me that this thing works and it will continue to work. You know, step three talks about made a decision. That's, you know, I'm going to get out the car. I'm going to walk in. I'm going to have a seat. And I'm going to do whatever they say do. So what I heard was get a sponsor. Work the steps. Share with others. Be available. Let your word be your word. Let it be your word. Before I used to give people my word and then I changed my mind, but not advise them. You know, not tell them that, hey, my mind has changed, and it was changed after I got your money. And when I tell you I'll be right back, I might not be right back. You know, y'all don't know what I'm talking about. You know, and then when you said to sit down and write, you know, to draw the columns and put the things that were relevant in each column, and then find someone to sit down and tell it all to. I don't have to put it on Facebook or on Instagram. I don't even have to share it all in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got to find one somebody that I can tell it all to. And once I've done that, I was able to then receive some open feedback. You know, because whereas I was telling myself that I was just the worst, I had somebody in front of me saying, yeah, you did some stuff, you know, but you're a good person, you know. You know, we're not in here bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well, you know, and to have another man in front of me share some of his things, you know, some of the stuff he did, you know, and not be that alone anymore. You know, I would be lonely in a room full of people just thinking that none of you are going to understand me. You're never going to understand why I did what I did. You're never going to connect with that insatiable urge. We call it a phenomenon of craving. Whereas I didn't even have any choice. You know? You know, once I sat down and I did that work, having had that exposure to another man's stuff, it kind of told me that I wasn't the worst. I needed to hear that. It didn't say you're a great guy, you're an angel. Never did it say that. But it said you weren't the worst. And you're not a POS. You know, because You can't hear it, but there's a voice always speaking to me. And without the power of my higher power running through me, it's not going to say anything positive. You know, I'll be in a room with 100 people and just one of those 100 don't like me. And you think I'm going to focus on the 99? No, I'm going to focus on that one. I wonder why he don't like me. What did I do? How can I make him like me? You know? And I put my own life on pause until I get to that place where, yeah, I think he likes me now. Now it's to hell with him. Who's next? You know, that's just the way my brain works. We're sick people trying to get well. You know, 6 and 7 talks about identifying character defects. You know, I'm not a sinister person, but I have done some sinister things. You know, and what that helps me do is not repeat that behavior. You know, I can tell you there were years that I looked at my life like SMH, man. It's got to get better than this, right? Not as long as you're doing what you're doing. You know, I would go into a neighborhood and I'd find the worst place to go. You know, those ill repute, those places of ill repute. You know, and I'd get there and I'd stay there until I found myself lost. You see, I don't want to be that alcoholic. I don't want to be that dope fiend, but it was happening. Came a time when I could not differentiate the truth from the false. And you couldn't tell whether I was telling the truth or not. You see, I had a goal. Ultimately, it was to get whatever you had, and I had to go about it right. Because if you mess this up, chances are small that you're going to get what you want. You know, so I would practice telling myself these lies. So when I said it to you, it sounded like the truth. You know, and the people we hurt the most, the people we steal from and rob the most are our families. You know, I'd walk into the house with my parents and my sister and my aunt and my mom would be in there, and I'd get in there and everybody's put their pocketbook under their asses. You know, they sit on it, you know, until I leave. It's one of those cases that you know, get me, you got me once, you ain't get me no more, you know. And I wonder today if they're over it. You know, because it's been 15 years. You know, you think that you come in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're here for 90 days and hey, why are y'all still hiding your pocketbook? I got 90 days sober. You know, come on. 90 days. You know, it's funny sometimes that, you know, the damage that we do is far reaching. You know, I got family in England and Africa and Australia and Canada. And anything I did somehow went around the world. You know, everyone would be either calling me or, you know, sending me a postcard saying, please try to be nicer to your mom. Try to treat your sister better. We're not bad people trying to get good. The sick people trying to get well. 6 and 7 allows me to look at those character defects and work on them. The awareness now, I am able to change something. This is a program of change. Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. AA stands for more than just Alcoholics Anonymous. It stands for actions and attitudes. You see, if my actions change, my attitude will change. If my attitude changes, there's a high probability that my actions will do the same. We're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. We're learning. Every day I'm a student of this program. I'm learning how to live a life of recovery. How not to steal. How not to brandish weapons and how not to hurt the people that we love. You know, I can tell you that, you know, there's a little part of me that gets a little high off of my behavior. God bless you. Gets a little high on some of the stuff that I do, the chances I took. You know, there's a little kickback. You know, you might not see it, but it's running inside of me. I stand here today, you know, with an open heart, and I'm free for that. I'm free from it as well. You know, I am still guilty of I love to drive fast. I love to fly down the highway. I'm working on it, you know. But I'm not drinking and doing it. And I used to tell myself that I was the best driver when I was drunk, you know. And you add a little bit more, you know, some more drugs, and I get better. You know, I once told a guy, he's like, "No, I can't drive when I'm sober. I need to get a couple of drinks in me and maybe a little blunt." You know, and that makes sense to us, but to others, they look at Troy. What? You need what? Yeah, that's what I need. And that'll make me a better driver, a better lover, a better dancer, a better friend. These are the things that we tell ourselves, and it's a lie. But I believe it because it's a lie being told to me in my own voice, in my own head. You know, step 8 requires that I make a list. And it didn't say, go jump right out and go talk to these people. It says, get yourself ready first. And what that looks like is like, use your sponsor, you know, sound some stuff off of them. Make a list, you know, of some people that you need to go make amends to. And once you got that list together, sit down with your sponsor and ask him, you know, how should I approach this situation? Get some direction. Because if you use your brain, you might not do it right. I remember I came in here and I think I was on step 2. And I wanted to go back to New York and make amends. I wanted to go tell everybody, you know, this is what I did, and, you know, I'm sorry. And, you know, my sponsor said, "Nah, man, this is not about saying I'm sorry. You just do them in order." But I made a decision to go to New York anyway. And I got to New York and I mustered up. I increased the pain. I increased the damage. And if you don't think that that's possible, please, try it for yourself. Try it, out of order. I came back a little bit more humble, a little bit more willing to do it the way that my sponsors are. Follow some direction. You know, I found a woman that fell in love with me, and so, you know, if you're in love with me, then I must be in love with you. Isn't that how that works? Love American style, right? So I asked her to marry me, and she agreed. And she was made for me. She was perfect. Her dad came back from Vietnam, strung out on heroin. So my little problem didn't seem like nothing to her. You know, we were married 7 years, and you know, the day we got married, she was like, "Let's build a family. Let's have children." And I was like, "Yeah, sure, no problem." And in my head, I was saying, "If we have kids, that means it's going to take money out of my pocket, and I'm not going to be able to do what I want." No. So for 7 years, I made her wait. 7 years. You know, and in those 7 years, she watched me circle the drain. You know, it was the last year of my using was one of the most tumultuous years in my life. You know, that October, we found her father in Brooklyn with a spike in his arm. He had overdosed. And how we found out was that I was at her mother's house, cooking dinner, and the phone rang, and her mom said, "Can you grab that?" And I picked it up, and I was like, "Hello?" And the voice on the other end says, "Is this the Morgan residence?" And I was like, "Yeah." And it's like, "Are you related to him?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm their son." Lie. And then he goes, "Well, sir, unfortunately," and any time a sentence starts with "unfortunately," it is nothing nice, you know. And I said, hold on for a second. And I put the phone to my chest and I looked in the living room, and they were all watching Jeopardy and laughing. And I knew whatever this was going to interrupt that. And I got back on the phone and I said, yes, what's going on? And he says, this is Officer XYZ of the New York City Fire Department, and we found Mr. Morgan in Brooklyn, and we tried for 20 minutes to revive him, but we were unable to. He's passed, and we need someone to come and identify the body. After speaking with him and looking at them, I got off the phone. And I went in the living room, and I stood in front of the TV, and they're like, Dad, get out of the way! And I was like, guys, I got some news for you. And then they got serious, and I got serious, and I told them that they found Dennis, and he was dead. And I got a chance to see what addiction does to a family. I saw all three of those women on the ground crying, grabbing at the carpet and at each other. I saw them, I saw the total desperation on their face. Their hearts were broken and shattered. You see, I understand that there's things that we do that we can't see sometimes. Sometimes we're not there when they get the call, you know, that we're in jail or we're in the hospital or something has happened to us. That we had drank ourselves into such a stupor that we fell down a staircase and cracked our skulls open. Alcoholism kills in more than just medical ways. It kills in accidents. You know, we went down to the city morgue and we identified his body. And that was October. In November, my little cousin and I decided that we were going to go to Atlantic. What is it called? What's the casino place in Jersey?
Atlantic City.
What is it?
Atlantic City.
Atlantic City. And we're riding through Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue, and he's like, pull right over here. Let's go get some supplies. And you know what supplies look like, right? They all come in these little bags. And he went in, and I'm in the car, and I see a car pull up behind us. It looked like a black Acura, and the music was bumping. And two guys got out of the car with hoodies and ran into the store. It's like a bodega. You guys know what bodegas are? And then a little while later, two of them come running out, jumped in the car. The car backs up and takes off. And I sit in the car, and I'm waiting for my cousin Frank to come out of the store, and he never comes out. I get out of the car and I walked in and he's laying on the floor bleeding from the ear. You know, shots fired. The guy behind the glass is on the phone with the police and, you know, to this day they still haven't found those people. You know, that was November. My wife and I bought a house in Long Island and my sister suggested that we had a tough year. We need to have a housewarming. And, we invited the family and friends over, and they all came. And, you know, when we first moved in that house, we backed the truck up, and I got out, and I raised the back gate. And as I'm raising the gate, this guy two doors down sticks his head out of the door, and he's like, hey, you need any help? I was like, why, yes, I do. And he came out, and he helped me take some stuff into the house, and he's helping me lift the heavy things, and I really appreciated his help. And then he asked me that question, you know that question.
You get high?
Why, yes I do. And he's like, well, once we're done, you know, let's go get it. You know, and we went and we got some beer and some booze and some other things. And we formed a fast friendship. He immediately became my best friend. You know, that's how we make friends. You know, if you drink like I drink and you drug like I drug, we're friends. You know, that's all that's required. Nothing more. Nothing moral. You know, no upstanding standard. And it came a time when he and I shared more than just drugs and alcohol. We shared a love for guns, you know. And he turned me on to all the right people so I can get everything I needed, you know. And we used to go out into my backyard and had a huge tree back there, and we used to use the tree for target practice. And I could tell you that it was a regular occurrence. But New Year's Eve came, and all the while we were hearing that Y2K was impending. You know, so the airplanes were going to fall out of the sky. You know, the TVs aren't going to work. Your car's not going to start. Everything's going to come to a standstill. You know, Y2K. Y'all remember that?
Yeah.
So we had a housewarming party on New Year's Eve, and we had like 85 candles burning just in case the electricity went out. And we were playing oldies music, you know, and everything was retro, you know. My wife and her mom and her two aunts were there, and my parents and sisters were there, and there were kids running all over the place. It seemed to be a good time, you know. And the ball dropped at 12. And as the ball dropped, you know, it seemed like we were getting drunker and drunker. And at about 12:04, someone came knocking at the door, and it was my new best friend. And I went down and I opened the door, and I can tell you this, that I stood in front of him and I looked him in his face, and I can tell you I didn't see any whites in his eyes. They were just like black orbs. You know, maybe I might have been drunk, you know, or maybe something else was going on. We talk a lot about our higher power, but let's not forget that there's a lower power as well, and he too is at work. And that evening, I believe that he came to my door. I opened the door and I invited him in, and as we walked into the living room, I said, "Everybody, this is my friend Vince. This is my family." We came upstairs, and there was the kitchen, and all the young folks were in the kitchen, and all the older folks were down in the living room, and the kids were running around in the bedrooms upstairs. And I fixed him a plate of food and asked him if he wanted something to drink, and got him all set, and I got myself a plate, and I sat on the stairs going upstairs, and I'm eating, and he comes and stands in front of me, and he lifts his shirt up, and he says, "Look what I got." And it was a nickel plate of 357 Mac. I said, "Nice gun, man." He said, "Let's go out back and celebrate the new year." And I was like, "I got my family here. The kids are running around. I don't think the time is right. It's late at night. It's not a good idea." And I said, "I'm really not comfortable with you having it around the family either. Let me get that." And I took it out of his waist, and I went upstairs, and I opened up the lockbox where I kept mine, and I put his in there, and I locked it up, came back downstairs, picked up my plate, sat back on the stairs, and I'm eating again. And all of a sudden, he's running back and forth in the kitchen, scratching his head, telling me to go get his bitch, go get his bitch. I said, "All right, I get it, but, you know, you're going to have to go, man, because I can't have that here." So I went upstairs, and I opened up the lockbox, and I looked at the stand. I said, "You know, I should just take the bullets out of his head." And I said, "He's just downstairs. He's just right next door. He's got bullets in his car. He's got bullets in his house. I'm just going to put the safety on and give it back to him, and I'm going to tell him to leave." So I did just that. I came downstairs. I called him over, gave him a hug, put it in his waist. Told him to have a happy new year. I'll talk to him later. And he walks down the stairs, and at this time my wife's aunts and are acting like they're the Supremes, and they're singing into these hairbrushes. "Stop!" And he walks past them and he said, "Ladies, you're going to hear a couple of gunshots. Please don't be alarmed. I mean, just celebrating the new year." So he goes out the door, and as he's going out the door, I'm going back up into the kitchen. But I'm keeping my eye on him, and I can see him open the door, and then he's walking out. And as he's walking out, I can see him pull out the pistol, and then he closed the door. I'm still looking, and nobody else is paying attention. You know, and I hear pow outside the door. And just right around then, the music is still playing loudly, and I can see that my wife's aunt Valerie is like, plopping down in front of in the chair that's in front of the window, and she's like, "Lord, I'm tired." And she's kind of a big woman, and you know, she was kind of tuckered out. And she's sitting in the chair, and I heard pow again, and then I heard pow again, and I saw the curtain move, and it went through her head. You know, her brain is blown apart. You know, no one else is seeing this, and I'm running down the stairs now trying to get to her. And by the time I got to her, she had already slid down, and I could see a trail of blood on the back of the couch. And I caught her just before she hit the ground, and my hand was in the back of her head, and it went almost all the way into her skull. By this time, everybody sees what's going on, and the house turns into pandemonium. I'm screaming to my wife, throw some towels down, and she's throwing these towels down, and I'm packing them, and they're just going right up into her skull. You know, she's looking at me, and I can see her. She's got just tears, but she just doesn't know what happened. I see it in her face that she's... All she wants to know is, what happened? I told my wife to call 911, and it didn't take long. They were there pretty quickly. I could feel the police pulling me up off of her so that 911 guys can get at her, and they're holding me, and I could see them working on her, and the EMT looks back at me, and it's like, she's gone. You know, by this time, everybody is upstairs in the bedrooms now, and I had to go upstairs, and I'm covered with her blood and matter. And I get up the stairs, and I open the door, and everybody's on their knees praying. And all I did was shook my head, and the house turned into pandemonium again. You see, I tell you this not because of my behavior, but because of the behavior of alcoholics and addicts, people get hurt. You know, it can be as extreme as death, but it doesn't have to be. I believe that the God I serve today has been trying to get my attention for a long time. That he's been tickling me with a feather, and I just didn't pay attention. And he's also that guy that if he tickles you with a feather once, twice, three times, he's going to have no other choice but to hit you with a 3x4. He's going to have his way. He's going to have his way. You know, that was the first murder that year, and for the next week, every time we got out of the house, we couldn't even stay in our own house. We had to stay in my in-law's house, which was really sexy, because this was her sister that died, and you know, I was the one commonality. So I'm staying in this house, and I tell you, if it was a refrigerator, it would have been warmer. You know, no one said anything, but you felt it. You know, the pain, and it erupted sometimes, and all I could do is just take it. My parents at that time had moved down to Atlanta, and they had saw it on CNN, and they called me, and they were like, "It's time for you to make a change. You got to change something, Troy. Why don't you come down here and maybe start again?" Because by this time, my wife was refusing to go back in that house. You know, she ain't living there, and I didn't have any new ideas. So I came down to Atlanta, running, escaping, because, you know, I'm living in this house with my in-laws, and that was not fun. So I needed to get out. So I came down here. But it's funny that no matter where you go, there you are. You bring you with you. So I came down here, and I found the same people. They were just called by different names, but it's the same people. Instant best friends. But now I'm carrying the guilt and the shame of years gone past. Now I came down here, and I came down here with a subconscious decision to hit, to do it, to hit it. You know, and I did, I hit it hard. You know, I came down here and I found a job with Equifax, and one day I came in and I couldn't see right. You know, it was, everything was like in a prism. You know, it was colors and my peripheral was messed up. And, you know, I just went into my director's office and I said, I'm not feeling good. And I didn't tell him that, you know, I had been drinking and smoking and everything for the last 4 or 5 months. I didn't tell him that I was circling this drain, you know, and that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. I omitted that information. So I told him I was leaving and I was going to go home and go to the doctor in the morning. And I got in the car and jumped on 285, and I had just passed La Vista, and my right eye just went black. And then a little while later, my left eye went black. And the last I remember, I was doing like 65, 70 miles an hour, because I like to drive. And I'm driving, and the car is moving, and I'm blind as a bat. And I don't know why, because up north, you know, when we pull over to the right. But for whatever reason, I pulled over to the left and stopped the car, found my phone, and called 911. They came, and they came rather quickly, and I heard a knock on the window, and I put the window down, and I hear a voice saying, what's going on, sir? And I said, I lost my vision, and I'm sitting there crying like a little girl, and he's like, you lost your vision? I was like, yes, I can't see a thing. And he says, okay. He says, take the seatbelt off, and we'll pull you through the window. I said, pull me through the window? The door works. He says, there's no room for us to open the door. You got about an inch clearance for the median. I don't know about you, but God lets me know that I've been contacted sometimes. But sometimes, and this is my story, you have spiritual experiences even when you're getting drunk, even when you're getting high. But you're not spiritually awake, so you're not aware of it. But I haven't worked the steps, and I can tell you that step 12 is an awakening that tells me that you have been contacted a long time ago. Do you remember when you went blind on 285? Who do you think got you out of there? Do you remember when your house was shot up? Who do you think got you out of there? You know, and this revelation didn't come right away. It was a spiritual experience, but it needed some work to manifest. And I needed to work the steps. I needed to find a competent sponsor, somebody who could speak not just to me, but to my spirit and wake it up. Now, having had a spiritual experience, now it's my turn to go help somebody else. This thing is something that we give away. That night they took me into this ambulance, and as I'm in the ambulance, I could feel them putting stuff on me and sticking me, and I'm crying like a girl. And you know what we do when we're in our most desperate situation? We want our mothers. I'm like, somebody call my mom, please. Begging them. And they said, we'll take care of that when we get to the hospital. And a little while later, I hear the EMT guy goes, damn. And I was like, damn, damn what? And he's like, your blood sugar is at 866. And I was like, yeah, what's that, a high score? What? And he's like, no, it's not good. He says, we need to get you to the hospital right away, or else you may have a stroke. And then finally, they get me to the hospital, South DeKalb Hospital, and I go through the emergency room, and I feel them pushing me into a treatment room, and people are sticking me, and you know, I felt like a pincushion. And a little while later, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes, an hour, I can hear somebody come in, and just as an aside, this is what we do. Alcoholics and addicts, this is what we do. This man comes in, and he introduced himself as the doctor of the ER, and I could hear him shuffling papers around, and he says, Mr. Abrams, Do you drink any alcohol? You don't ask an alcoholic that. You're going to get this very same answer. Yeah, one or two beers. You know, the game's on. And he's like, how about street drugs? You do any street drugs? What? Any street drugs? Yeah, you know, smoke a little weed. You know, the game is on. And he said, well, could you explain the alcohol and the cocaine and the mescaline that we found in your blood? And my response to him was to leave me the F alone. And I can hear him back up. And that's what we do. The folks that are around that help us, we push them away. You go help somebody who needs help. I'm good. Even though you're in the depth of your misery, even though that you can't see a way out or a solution, your pride, your ego, and all that conspire to bring the most disgusting things out of your mouth. Leave me the F alone. Go help somebody who needs it. I heard him back away, but somehow he didn't give up, and they took me in the hospital, and it was discovered that I had shut down my pancreas, and he was telling me that I'm now a diabetic, and that I have to change. Do you see a common thread? That we have to change in order to live with the disease that we have. That there are steps that we must take in order to survive this thing. And if you got what I got, and if you're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God, you are a survivor. And you got to do certain things to maintain this. Yeah. And I will wrap it up, and I want to thank you all for your patience in listening to me tonight. As you can see, I am a survivor. I'm still here 15 years later. And I'm not special, I'm garden variety. The stories that I told, I'm sure you have your own. I welcome them, you know, after this. If you need me, please don't hesitate to call me. 678-596-8683. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks again, Troy. Thank you so much. And Troy has voluntold somebody to come up here and give the chip. Steve, I believe.
Thank you, Steve. And I'm alcoholic.
Here at NABA Club, we have a chip system to mark our time in sobriety. We'll start with the white chip. You want to try this way of life? Silver for 30 days. Red for 90 days. Yellow, you've become one of the bunch, 6 months. Grass is growing between you and the liquor store, 9 months. Blue chip for years or multiples.
Hey!
So this is Matt. I've known Matt ever since he kind of started this journey a year ago. God, I can't believe it's been a year. Bar none, you will find nobody more dedicated to this program. Really tries to work with other people, and just all around a great guy. And I'm proud of you, man, and I love you.
I'm Matt, I'm an alcoholic. And I guess it was right at a year ago, I called that man and told him that, I said, I can't stop. I don't know what's wrong. I said, I can't stop. And even though the process that began ended me up in Rice Street for a month, rehab after that, those were the steps that it needed for me for my bottom to happen. It's been a great journey, and one of the things that, I don't know if y'all say it here, but we say at our home group is at the end of the prayer, keep coming back, it works if you work it. I didn't understand that. What's it? The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was like, well, he works it this way, he works it that way. You know, how do I do that? And you know, someone said, well, just find the program that works for you. Well, my program was coming to a meeting and then getting a six-pack on the way home.
Right.
That didn't work. But I found people that it was working for, and I grabbed a hold of some of them, and it has been an amazing, amazing ride. And it's I read in the promises, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but it always materializes if you work for it. When I first began and I would read that, I'd add my own little two cents in there and say, sometimes quickly, sometimes painfully slow. Or amazingly slow. Because, you know, when I had 1, 2, 3 months, it seemed like it would be forever. But it's amazing how quick things have happened, you know, once I gave myself into this program and started working. And the same thing can happen to you. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, man.
Any more blue chips? Also, I'm not a cop and didn't physically put him in Rice Street, so please don't cue my car later. And I'm going to offer the white chip one more time. God gave me another chance.
Thank you.
All right, thanks one and all for joining the blue chip speakers meeting tonight.
Seems like everyone's out.